do not apply. Consider the following. First, it is not a crime for a U.S. citizen to be paid for consulting services rendered for a foreign government. Second, it is not a crime for U.S. citizens to move money earned overseas into the United States through offshore banks, even if the banks are domiciled in known offshore money laundering jurisdictions, such as the Cayman Islands or the Seychelles. Third, as long as Manafort and Gates reported the income and paid all required federal taxes, it is not a crime to deposit in a U.S. bank funds owned overseas that were moved into the U.S. banking system via transfers involving offshore banks. Compare this to the HSBC case, in which Mueller, Comey, Lynch, and Holder all knew the bank was involved in the criminal money laundering of hundreds of millions of dollars, a vastly larger sum than was involved in the Manafort-Gates case, for heinous international narcotics cartels and terror groups resolved to kill Americans. Yet Mueller, Comey, Lynch, and Holder were satisfied to be paid a fine that to HSBC amounted to nothing more than the cost of doing business. Why? As ZeroHedge.com pointed out in 2015, after revelations from a trove of secret documents from HSBC's Swiss private bank, #SwissLeaks, HSBC could no longer claim the money laundering was due to a few rogue employees and a loosely enforced anti-money laundering policy. The truth is that a considerable portion of the global banking system is explicitly dedicated to handling the enormous volume of cash produced daily by dope traffickers, ZeroHedge.com noted. The Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations concluded that HSBC also had a long-standing relationship with Saudi Arabia's Al Rajhi Bank, described by the CIA in 2003 as a conduit for extremist finance. U.S. intelligence had assessed that Al Rajhi founder Suleiman bin Abdul Aziz Al Rajhi was a member of Osama bin Laden's golden chain financiers of Al-Qaeda, and had, in that capacity, pushed Al Rajhi Bank to find ways to avoid subjecting the bank's charitable donations to official scrutiny. Finally, since the Vietnam War, HSBC was the CIA's money laundering bank of choice to launder the proceeds the CIA was deriving from running the international heroin trade originating in Southeast Asia. Journalist and political activist Dean Henderson documented the following in his 2007 book, Big Oil and Their Bankers in the Persian Gulf, Four Horsemen, Eight Families, and Their Global Intelligence, Narcotics, and Terror Network. Formerly known as Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation, HSBC has served as the world's number one drug money laundry since its inception as a repository for British Crown opium proceeds accrued during the Chinese Opium Wars. During the Vietnam War, HSBC laundered CIA heroin proceeds. Peter Dale Scott, in his 2014 book, The American Deep State, Big Money, Big Oil, and the Struggle for U.S. Democracy, made a similar observation. Since World War II, the CIA has made systemic use of drug trafficking forces to increase its covert influence, first in Thailand and Burma, then in Laos and Vietnam, and most recently in Afghanistan. With America's expansion overseas, we have seen more and more covert programs and agencies, all using drug traffickers to different and opposing ends. Evidently, with the HSBC criminal money laundering case in 2012, FBI Director Mueller agreed with future FBI Director Comey, along with then U.S. Attorneys Loretta Lynch and General Eric Holder, that it was better to let HSBC off the hook than take the risk that a fearless defense attorney would expose the CIA's role in the international drug trade. Investigative journalist Nafiz Ahmed, in a 2015 article titled Death, Drugs, and HSBC, said that it is fairly simple once one understands that fraudulent blood money makes the world go around. Matt Taibbi, writing in Rolling Stone in 2013, capsulized the HSBC case in the title of his article, Gangster Bankers, Too Big to Jail, subtitled, How HSBC Hooked Up with Drug Traffickers and Terrorists and Got Away with It. The HSBC settlement will haunt Mueller and his witch hunt once the American public realizes the Manafort-Gates prosecution is, at best, a case of technical violations in failing to register or possibly tax evasion. But the case has nothing whatsoever to do with money laundering, since consulting with Ukraine is not a crime in the United States. Rather, the goal of Mueller's indictment is to establish the pretense for undermining Donald Trump's presidency politically and possibly lead to impeachment. What we must realize from the start is that even if there were evidence that the Trump campaign had colluded with Russia, there is no federal law that makes collusion a crime. What the HSBC criminal case and the Manafort-Gates indictment prove is that deep state actors, including Mueller, Gates, Lynch, and Holder, can be counted on to protect their own. Prosecution by newspaper. Former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara, a Trump critic ever since the president fired him from his position, may turn out to be an unanticipated liability for Special Counselor Robert Mueller. Once Mueller added Assistant U.S. Attorney Andrew Goldstein, one of Bharara's former top prosecutors, to his special prosecutor staff, Mueller took on the burden of explaining why he thereby implicitly condoned a pattern of illegal leaking of secret grand jury information, which has plagued Bharara's high-visibility prosecution since 2014. Specifically, Mueller may have to explain how his pattern of leaking to the press differs from the illegal leaking of grand jury information to the New York Times and Washington Post that Bharara had to admit happened in his prosecution of William T. Walters, a prominent businessman, investor, sports gambler, and philanthropist that Bharara convicted of insider trading in a U.S. District Court criminal trial that ended last July. The federal criminal case for insider trading against noted Las Vegas-based sports gambler William T. Billy Walters was seriously impaired in December 2016 when the U.S. District Court Judge P. Kevin Castell, in preparing to take the case to trial, learned that FBI agent Chavez had leaked information on the case to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal 2 years before Walters was indicted. What the record reveals is that despite being unable to develop enough evidence to justify a grand jury indictment regarding Walters' trading of either Clorox or Dean Foods stock, Chavez decided in April 2014 that he would prevent the investigation from going dormant by going to the press and illegally spilling juicy details from the grand jury investigation that he hoped might somehow revive the case. When Judge Castell understood the extent of Chavez's leak, he demanded that U.S. Attorney Bharara prepare for the court a complete accounting of the FBI leaking activity in the case, a report that Judge Castell required the U.S. Attorney's Office to make public in an unsealed and non-redacted form, including the names of the reporters at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal who cooperated with Chavez, as well as a full timeline accounting for the numerous leaks both newspapers published. Thus, court documents prove that U.S. Attorney Bharara allowed the New York Times and Wall Street Journal to publish fake news as he prepared an insider trading case against Billy Walters. In July, President Trump issued a volley of angry tweets after the Washington Post reported, again based on anonymous sources, that Trump had asked his attorneys and advisors about his ability to pardon aides, family members, and possibly even himself as a means of limiting or undercutting Mueller's Russia investigation. In response to the Washington Post story, Trump tweeted, "While we all agree the U.S. president has the complete power to pardon, why think of that when the only crime so far is leaks against us? Fake news." All crooked cops. Attorney Sidney Powell, a former assistant U.S. attorney and appellate section chief, in her 2014 book, License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice, argues that prosecutorial impropriety runs rampant today among Department of Justice prosecutors, including Bharara, as well as among the lawyers recruited to Special Counselor Mueller's team. "Why did Preet Bharara prosecute Billy Walters?" Powell asked rhetorically. Bharara prosecuted Billy Walters because Walters was a famous and hugely successful sports gambler, because he was a multi-million dollar investor who owned a $17 million private jet. because Preet Bharara had suffered a series of appeals court setbacks, and he valued bagging Billy Walters so he could have a new trophy to put on his wall. She noted that the trial judge in Billy Walters' case, U.S. District Judge Castell, forced Bharara to admit that FBI Special Agent Chavez had engaged in a systematic pattern of illegally leaking grand jury information against Walters to the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, starting 2 years before Bharara indicted Walters. Again, doesn't surprise me at all that prosecutors and agents in such a high-profile case leaked information, Powell responded. Federal prosecutors often try to convict in the press before the indictment or trial. Many top federal law enforcement officials, including James Comey, and it appears Robert Mueller as well, are willing to engage in illegal acts to win convictions, she stressed. They convince themselves or believe that someone is guilty of something, and then the end of obtaining any kind of conviction justifies whatever needs to be done to get that conviction, she continued. Bharara, Comey, and Mueller. All three are far too political and have great powers of rationalization. Some have called them dirty cops. Assange charges CIA is targeting U.S. citizens on the Internet. On March 8, 2017, in a live-streaming Internet press conference, Julian Assange announced that there are some 22,000 IP Internet protocol addresses in the WikiLeaks database that are based in the United States, triggering Assange to suspect that the CIA has continued to go rogue, violating its charter not to investigate U.S. citizens. Unfortunately, the CIA does have a history of attacking not only the political parties operating overseas. The CIA has a history of acting badly within the United States as well, Assange said. There are more than 22,000 IP addresses in the Vault 7 documents that correspond to Internet systems within the United States, he continued. We have a large project underway to determine how many of those IP addresses in the United States were attack victims and how many were intermediaries, say an Internet service provider in the United States that was attacked in order to attack someone else overseas. How many are direct victims and how many correspond to a visitor from a foreign country to the United States? Or how many correspond to a joint intelligence operation with the CIA providing technical support to an intelligence operation overseas? A strategy to gain control of the out-of-control White House press room. Holding daily press conferences with the mainstream media, sitting in the first rows of a crowded press room, gives the deep state and media agents an undeserved level of respect. If the pro-Clinton, pro-Obama jackals of the mainstream media are shut out from attacking the White House press secretary on a daily basis, the mainstream loses an important stage on which to be viewed live in real time on cable news. Mainstream media White House correspondents should be treated as enemies, not honored celebrities if they are resolved to act as enemies. In other words, answering questions such as, "When did you stop beating your wife?" shouted out by reporters presuming the righteousness of their attacks only serves to advance the coup's narrative. Ending daily press conferences is an important point to silencing the mainstream media by making White House press correspondents the outsiders they truly are. Currently, the White House press room occupies the corridor attaching the White House to the West Wing, where President John Kennedy housed the White House pool, in which he infamously liked to cavort naked with his favorite female assistants, nicknamed Fiddle and Faddle. The space is small, cramped with reporters jammed into wooden center seats too small for comfort, with broadcast equipment occupying the space at the back, and no room for all but a few representatives of privileged news outlets. The White House press secretary could easily justify announcing that the White House press room in the West Wing is being closed for renovations. The White House press secretary should also make clear that coincident with the closing of the West Wing press room, the White House is undertaking a policy review to revise procedures for White House correspondents to obtain credentials and participate in daily press briefings. When the new policy is announced, the current West Wing press office should be closed, with a new press office opened in the executive office buildings across the street from the White House. Further, with daily press briefings suspended, the White House press office could resort to supplying White House correspondents with printed announcements only. These printed releases should begin by detailing requests being made by the White House legal counsel for Congress and the FBI to investigate the following. The extent to which the Obama administration had the Trump campaign under FISA-authorized electronic surveillance. The extent to which the Obama White House had unmasked the identity of Trump campaign officials under electronic surveillance. And the extent to which reports with Trump campaign officials unmasked were distributed within the Obama administration as well as to the press. Over a period of weeks, the White House press office could lay out for the American public these serious questions regarding Hillary Clinton, her 2016 campaign, the Clinton Foundation, and John and Tony Podesta. Questions designed to expose the full range of the deep state coup d'etat in progress, with the Democratic Party and the mainstream media identified as named co-conspirators. The new White House press office, opened in the executive office buildings, should be auditorium style, designed to accommodate several hundred press representatives. White House television correspondents seeking to broadcast from the White House lawn need to be moved across the street to a designated area outside the grounds. The ability of internet-based news agencies to obtain White House credentials should be greatly expanded, reducing the hold mainstream media newspapers, network television news, and cable network news have on front row status to dominate news conferences by asking the first questions. What must be put to an end is the ability of White House correspondents to utilize the daily press conference as an opportunity to continue the deep state resistance campaign by asking a series of gotcha questions aimed only at developing inconsistencies and or White House explanation shifts that can be exploited to perpetuate their impeachment-oriented strategy of perpetuating a hostile White House press environment. In summary, the White House counterattack against the mainstream media involves the following. The White House producing its own daily breaking news releases, attacking the Democrats, and demanding an expanded Department of Justice investigation into Obama administration unmasking, the Clinton campaign Russian collusion, and a list of other deep state offenses. The White House revising the rules for White House correspondents, ending daily press briefings, and moving the White House press office off-site. To win the counteroffensive on the mainstream media, the White House must take control of the news cycle, limiting the media's daily ability to attack President Trump in a cozy mainstream media-dominated pressroom facility located within the White House, where White House leakers are conveniently within reach. Conclusion. The fight to save President Trump. The Democrats, who have supported Russia since the Communist Revolution in 1917, decided to explain away Hillary Clinton's devastating loss by demonizing Russia. Ironically, Hillary, who failed to become president some 100 years after the Russian Revolution, has decided to encourage Democrats to renew the McCarthyism of the 1950s, evidently forgetting that Democrats in that time attacked Republicans backing McCarthy for making accusations without evidence, naming alleged communists that had penetrated the U.S. State Department, the U.S. military, and the arts, including Hollywood. As I have stressed throughout this audiobook, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama both won the presidency despite their socialist message, because both were charismatic politicians. Recalling Hillary's failure at the start of her husband's presidency to institute Hillary Care, Hillary Clinton has defined for some 35 years what it looks like to be so totally lacking in charisma as to be unable to compete on the national scene. This was evidenced both by the successful challenge Barack Obama raised to Hillary's candidacy in the 2008 Democratic presidential primaries, and by the challenge raised in 2016 by Bernie Sanders. As former DNC chairman Donna Brazile has made clear, the only way Hillary could beat Bernie was by hijacking the DNC and rigging the primaries in her favor. As a presidential candidate in 2016, Hillary ran on themes of class envy and race baiting. Hillary's constant berating of the top 1% was patently hypocritical, given the avarice she and her husband have demonstrated since first stepping onto the political stage in Arkansas. With the Clinton Foundation being run not as a charity, but as a vast criminal empire, one could easily come to the conclusion that for the Clintons, there is no such thing as enough money, such that their foundation regularly sold favors to the most corrupt third world criminals the Clintons could find, provided these thugs had money to donate. As for race baiting, Hillary's identity politics turned into a demonization of white privilege, so as to preach to people of color that their economic status had to do with decades of exploitation by white colonialists and imperialists. So despite demonizing Russia to explain her inadequacies as a presidential candidate, Hillary was proud to campaign on themes that are traditionally touted by the U.S. Communist Party. Her amplification of the left's identity politics, Hillary insisted that all Americans should be proud to elect a woman as president. Americans generally agreed, objecting only that Hillary would not be that woman. If the Democrats move hard left in the reaction to Hillary's devastating loss, as seems to be the case with La Raza, Tom Perez, and black Muslim Keith Ellison picked to head the DNC, the Democratic Party is headed to oblivion, doomed to be an insignificant political splinter party on the far left. Leftist professors, supported by Obama's decision to have the government subsidize all college student loans, have produced a generation of millennials with a predisposition to hate America in their embrace of socialist-provided free education, free medical care, and government-subsidized housing, backed ultimately by a taxpayer-provided annual income. Millennials falling for Bernie Sanders' promises are about to face the economic reality that forces all socialist-oriented governments to go bankrupt and turn on their followers, who continue to demand yet more free stuff. The deep state broadens Russian collusion to include ExxonMobil. In July 2017, deep state Obama loyalists in the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, filed an action against ExxonMobil, charging that the corporation had signed agreements with Russia that violated sanctions the United States had imposed on Russia after its interference in Crimea and Ukraine. Trump supporters interpreted the attack from within the Treasury Department on ExxonMobil as an attempt by the deep state to discredit Trump's Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who joined the gas and oil giant in 1975 and rose to serve as chairman and CEO from 2006 to 2017. At the center of the dispute are interactions ExxonMobil had with the Russian oil company Rosneft and with Igor Sechin. The Treasury Department asserts that ExxonMobil violated the Ukraine-related sanctions by signing with Rosneft on or about May 14, 2014, and again on or about May 23, 2014. 8 different legal documents related to oil and natural gas projects in Russia that Sechin signed in his capacity as president of Rosneft. The problem is that during the Obama administration, White House and Treasury Department officials repeatedly clarified that the sanctions imposed by the U.S. Treasury on Russia on April 28, 2014, only applied to Sechin with regard to his personal affairs and not to the various companies that Sechin managed or represented, including Rosneft. The Treasury Department press release dated April 28, 2014, that announced sanctions on Sechin named a total of 7 Russian government officials and 17 Russian businesses that were being placed under sanctions over Russia's involvement in Ukraine. On this point, the Treasury Department press release commented that Rosneft is a state-owned company and has not been sanctioned. In filing the federal lawsuit, the attorneys for ExxonMobil argued that the company followed clear guidance from the White House and Treasury Department. When ExxonMobil signed documents with Russia, there should have been no problem involving ongoing oil and gas activities in Russia with Rosneft, a non-sanctioned entity, that were countersigned on behalf of Rosneft by Sechin in his official capacity. The ExxonMobil attorneys also noted that at the time of the signing, there was no direct U.S. sanction regarding pursuing an oil and natural gas joint venture with Russia. A legal memorandum on Ukraine-related sanctions, published by the prestigious law firm Sullivan & Cromwell LLP, dated May 2, 2014, strongly suggests that ExxonMobil did nothing wrong, including legal agreements with Rosneft that Sechin signed as CEO. Notably, the most recent designations include Igor Sechin, the president and management board chairman of Rosneft, Russia's leading petroleum company, but do not include Rosneft itself, the Sullivan and Cromwell memo specified. On March 17, 2014, a White House fact sheet said, "Our current focus is to identify these individuals and target their personal assets, but not companies that they may manage on behalf of the Russian state." The position was confirmed on May 16, 2014, by a Treasury Department spokesperson, who said, by way of example, that BP's American CEO was permitted to participate in Rosneft board meetings with Sechin, so long as the activity related to Rosneft and not Sechin's personal business. The core issue of the ExxonMobil lawsuit is that OFAC changed the rules after giving ExxonMobil guidance in 2014. At the time, allowing Sechin to sign the Rosneft contracts did not violate any sanctions. The ExxonMobil brief in the federal district court case reads in part as follows. OFAC now seeks to penalize ExxonMobil retroactively based on 8 documents executed in May 2014 with Rosneft Oil Company, Rosneft, the Russian state-owned oil company, the documents. At the time those documents were executed in 2014, Rosneft was not subject to any sanctions, and no sanctions prohibited the activities called for or reflected in those documents. Instead, the sole basis of OFAC's July 20, 2017 penalty notice, the penalty notice, is that the documents were signed on behalf of Rosneft by its president and chairman, Igor Sechin, who at the time was subject to sanctions only in his individual capacity. An interview published by Der Spiegel on September 2, 2014, describes Sechin as the second most powerful man in Russia, ranked second only to President Vladimir Putin in the complicated power structure in that country. Der Spiegel reported that Sechin and Putin have known each other since the 1990s, when the two worked together in the St. Petersburg government, with Putin appointing Sechin his deputy chief of staff during Putin's first term as president, then as deputy prime minister. The article also pointed out that Rosneft controls more oil and natural gas reserves than the energy giant ExxonMobil, with Rosneft producing 4.2 million barrels of oil daily, then estimated at almost 5% of global consumption. This case illustrates how quickly after Hillary Clinton's defeat that conducting legal business dealings with Russia had become suspect. How far will this go? In a reduction to the absurd, could it be used as evidence of treason that Donald Trump may have eaten at the Russian tea room in Manhattan, or that, as president, Trump was known to enjoy Russian salad dressing? Are all who order white Russians enemies of the state because they enjoy vodka? The point is that just as Democrats argued appropriately in the 1950s that McCarthyism had reached a level of absurdity when Senator Joe McCarthy asserted that he had a list with the names of 205 members of the State Department who were known communists, the same can be said of the Democrats today. That McCarthy waved a piece of paper in front of the Ohio County Women's Republican Club in Wheeling, West Virginia, did not constitute credible evidence proving that his assertion was true. Over the next few weeks, the numbers fluctuated wildly, with McCarthy at times asserting that there were 57 communists in the State Department, which changed to 10 communists the next day. Finally, McCarthy never proved there was even one communist in the State Department. At present, it is not a crime for a U.S. citizen to visit Russia, for a U.S. business to pursue an opportunity in Russia, or for a U.S. politician to have a discussion with a Russian politician. What Hillary Clinton and the Democrats managed to do in the aftermath of their devastating electoral loss in 2016 was make all these activities evidence of treason, even though there was no proof whatsoever that Donald Trump's campaign had colluded with Russia to cheat Hillary out of a victory that was rightfully hers. What the Democrats failed to understand was that the 2016 presidential election was never designated by any official body to be a coronation of Hillary Clinton, despite how much Hillary may have imagined that the presidency was her natural right to declare. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, Western politicians and business executives have sought to develop ties with Russia, ranging from the easing of travel restrictions to the encouragement of joint venture international business partnerships, including oil and natural gas exploration and distribution. Hillary Clinton and her followers reveal themselves as hypocrites in demonizing Russia, when globalists in the Democratic Party, such as Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Jimmy Carter's former national security advisor, openly express their hopes that the United States and Russia can work more closely together. Before his death, Brzezinski expressed his belief that supporting a Europe-oriented Russia is the way to end U.S. sanctions against Russia and resolve the painful Ukrainian issue through mutual compromise. On October 21, 2017, left-leaning columnist Maureen Dowd asked the 93-year-old former Democratic Party President Jimmy Carter if he thought Russia purloined the election from Hillary. "I don't think there's any evidence that what the Russians did changed enough votes or any votes," Carter answered her directly. Tech giants tell Senate Russia did not influence election. In their mad scramble to find some proof that Russia swayed the 2016 election, Hillary supporters began arguing that Russia influenced the election by posting on social media so as to detract from Hillary's campaign. For Hillary supporters, this was a result of the wink-wink the Trump campaign had going with Russia, namely, that one way or another, the Trump administration would benefit Russia once in office if Russia would pay to trash Hillary on social media. At a hearing of the Subcommittee on Crime and Terrorism of the Senate Judiciary Committee on October 31, 2017, Colin Stretch, general counsel for Facebook, testified that Russian interference before and after the election accounted for a small 0.004 percentage of all newsfeed traffic that was negative toward Hillary Clinton. Sean Edgett, acting general counsel for Twitter, and Richard Salgado, director of law enforcement and information security for Google, agreed that the Russian interference constituted a relatively small percentage of all content on their social media websites, adding that accounts identified as being Russian-controlled were terminated as quickly as they were recognized. In their prepared testimonies, each of the three social media companies attempted to estimate the extent of Russian interference during the 2016 U.S. presidential election cycle. Facebook. Facebook reported that the disinformation campaign associated with the Internet Research Agency, IRA, a Russian company located in St. Petersburg, spent approximately $100,000 on more than 3,000 Facebook and Instagram ads between June 2015 and August 2017. Facebook's analysis also showed that the IRA accounts used ads to promote the roughly 120 Facebook pages they had set up, which in turn posted more than 80,000 pieces of content between January 2015 and August 2017. Facebook estimated that 11.4 million people in the United States saw at least one of these ads between 2015 and 2017. Twitter. Twitter identified 36,746 accounts that generated automated election-related content and had at least one of the characteristics used to associate an account with Russia. During the relevant period, those accounts generated approximately 1.4 million automated election-related tweets, which collectively received approximately 288 million impressions. Twitter placed those numbers in context as follows. The 36,746 automated accounts that we identified as Russian-linked and tweeting election-related content represent approximately 0.01% 0.012% of the total accounts on Twitter at the time. The 1.4 million election-related tweets that we identified through our retrospective review as generated by Russian-linked automated accounts constituted less than 0.75%, 0.74% of the overall election-related tweets on Twitter at the time. Those 1.4 million tweets received only 0.33%, 0.33% of impressions on election-related tweets. In the aggregate, automated Russian-linked election-related tweets consistently underperformed in terms of impressions relative to their volume on the platform. Twitter estimated that fewer than 5% of all 360 million accounts active during the election period were identified with a foreign nation-state actor. Google. Google attempted to distinguish itself from the other two websites, arguing that its search algorithms do not lead to the same viral content as do Facebook and Twitter's. Google reported finding only two accounts during the election cycle that appeared to be engaged in activity associated with known or suspected government-backed entities. These two accounts spent approximately $4,700 in connection with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Google also reported finding 18 channels on YouTube with approximately 1,100 videos that were uploaded by individuals who are suspected to be associated with the Russian effort to influence the U.S. presidential election and contained political content. These videos mostly had low view counts, with just 3% having more than 5,000 views, constituting only 43 hours of content. This is a relatively small amount of content. In general, people watch more than a billion hours of YouTube content a day, with 400 hours of content uploaded every minute. Twitter admits to blocking anti-Hillary tweets during 2016 campaign. In the same Senate hearing, Twitter's Sean Edgett admitted that the site employed algorithms designed to monitor hashtags critical of Hillary Clinton, including hashtag Podesta emails and hashtag DNC leaks. This admission opens the door for Congress to demand that social media giants like Twitter, Facebook, and Google YouTube explain the full range of detection systems they used in the 2016 campaign to censor content favorable to Trump or critical of Clinton in what appears to have been an effort to influence the outcome of the election. In the quote that follows, Edgett couched Twitter's censorship efforts as justified by citing the company's fight to keep automation and spam off the platform. But Twitter neglected to explain whether the company's detection systems were equally protective of Trump. Here is what Edgett admitted in his prepared statement. Before the election, we also detected and took action on activity relating to hashtags that has since been reported as manifestations of efforts to interfere with the 2016 election. For example, our automated spam detection systems helped mitigate the impact of automated tweets promoting the Podesta emails hashtag, which originated with WikiLeaks publication of thousands of emails from the Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's Gmail account. The core of the hashtag was propagated by WikiLeaks, whose account sent out a series of 118 original tweets containing variants on the hashtag Podesta emails, referencing the daily installments of the emails released on the WikiLeaks website. In the 2 months preceding the election, around 57,000 users posted approximately 426,000 unique tweets containing variations of the Podesta emails hashtag. Approximately one quarter, 25% of those tweets received internal tags from our automation detection systems that hid them from searches. As described in greater detail below, our systems detected and hid just under half, 48%, of the tweets relating to variants of another notable hashtag, DNC leak, which concerned the disclosure of leaked emails from the Democratic National Committee. These steps were part of our general efforts at the time to fight automation and spam on our platform across all areas. Also disclosed in Edgett's testimony was that Twitter, on average, suspends the credentials of users suspected of using the website's application programming interface to post bot-generated automated tweets. The only example Edgett gave was the suspension of @PatrioticPepe, an account described as automatically relaying to all tweets from @RealDonaldTrump with spam content, an example that suggests Twitter was censoring pro-Trump tweets to find users employing automated spam posting techniques. Was Twitter equally as rigorous in suspending the credentials of those using automated spam posting engines to support Clinton? Edgett's testimony was silent on this point. Saving President Trump. Why Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 has less to do with Russia and more to do with the underlying reality that the United States is more divided now than at any time since the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861. What the Democrats failed to appreciate is that the tide of public opinion in the United States is turning against the liberalism that gave birth to Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society in 1964. After decades of an ever-expanding welfare state, we have not reduced poverty. Instead, today the United States faces the dilemma of being $20 trillion in debt, with the major promises of the Great Society no more fulfilled today than they were in 1964. Instead, welfare programs have created fatherless minority families. Urban centers are plagued by diminishing tax bases, decaying infrastructure, youth gangs, drug addiction, and escalating crime rates. States that have been controlled for decades by the Democratic Party are increasingly facing bankruptcy. Increasing taxes in these states only drives out productive businesses and tax-paying citizens, making it even more difficult to fulfill public pension obligations, repair degrading infrastructure, and increase public aid to education and health care. Aging populations in decaying Democratic Party-controlled cities are increasingly uncertain about how they will survive economically, even if they receive Social Security benefits. Instead of addressing honestly the failure of 1960s social welfare politics, Democratic Party leaders like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton still believe voters embrace the 1960s consensus that racial discrimination causes poverty. Proceeding on this mistaken presumption, Obama and Hillary, two Saul Alinsky community organizing acolytes, employed Alinsky's tactics of rubbing raw class and race conflicts to advance the left's socialist mission. But rather than finding enthusiasm in the wake of Black Lives Matter and Antifa protests, Obama and Clinton were dismayed that voters saw today's dissidents not as sympathetic 1960s civil rights marchers, but as violent thugs embracing nothing but political anarchy. Pursuing their open borders and unlimited immigration rights, the Democrats in 2016 were shocked to realize that the spirit of the Minuteman and Tea Party movements still persisted as voters rejected Hillary Clinton's globalist New World Order ambitions. The nationalism that put Donald Trump in the White House is the same nationalism that led Great Britain to vote for Brexit. Sweeping Europe today is a return to national identity that marks the beginning of the end to Jean Monnet's globalist view of creating a regional European Union government on the way to becoming a one-world government. Today, an increasing number of American voters are disenchanted with the hard left's view of a New World Order utopia. President Trump's rejection of the Paris Climate Accord was applauded by voters who see the treaty as nothing more than an international scheme to redistribute income sold under the guise of a climate crisis. Additionally, millions of Americans cheered when President Trump pulled out of UNESCO, convinced that those participating in United Nations peacekeeping missions raped women and created cholera, as was proven to be the case in Haiti following the catastrophic 2010 earthquake. Add to this the well-researched evidence that the Clinton Foundation may have stolen as much as $1 billion in the Clintons' enthusiasm to scam legitimate charity donations to rebuild Haiti. It remains to be seen whether the country will descend into a second civil war. But leftists in California and New York, who align with minority voters in the nation's inner cities, continue to demand the welfare state must expand, while voters in the red flyover states worry the United States is going bankrupt as increasing taxes steal wealth from productive and economically successful segments of our society. The premise of this audiobook is that President Trump will be saved, because the crux of the argument to remove him from office is founded in the corrupt politics that gave rise to Hillary Clinton's doomed presidential candidacy in 2016. But as the Democratic Party continues to support the violent extremism of movements like Black Lives Matter and Antifa, an increasing number of Americans in the flyover nation will cling even harder to their Bibles and their guns. Today's mainstream media is so corrupt in its partisan journalism that all Donald Trump has needed to reach the public directly has been the simplicity of a 140-word tweet. To those Americans who continue to believe in the Constitution of our founding fathers, Donald Trump's presidency is the last best hope. The Democratic Party of Hillary Clinton seems determined to champion radical groups like Black Lives Matter and Antifa in a United States of America in which the National Football League loses fans because a group of athletes kneel in protest to the playing of the national anthem. That the hard left hates the theme, Make America Great Again, is of little consequence to Donald Trump voters, who concluded that if Hillary Clinton followed Barack Obama into the White House, the left's utopian dream was certain to turn into Orwell's totalitarian nightmare. While it may take Trump 2 terms to complete the mission, there are already millions of Americans praying that God will afford him the opportunity to do so. The story of the 2016 election is that Hillary's deplorables won. The story, written in the first year of Donald Trump's presidency, is that those who vote for him expect to keep on winning. This recording of Killing the Deep State, The Fight to Save President Trump, was presented by Dreamscape Media, LLC. Text copyright 2018 by Jerome R. Corsi. Sound recording copyright 2018, Dreamscape Media, LLC. This recording was produced by arrangement with Humanics Books. Thank you for listening. Please check www.dreamscapeab.com for Dreamscape's latest releases.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.